When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Take the scenic drive to the Guitar Oasis Cool in Jefferson County. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, jeffsguitar.com.
Thanks to the United Steelworkers, another podcast from slysoffice.com. Today from the Lustron Broadcast Center, John Nichols joining us on the live line with us. He's with the Capital Times and the Nation. Comrade, interesting last couple days between what the Trump team pulled over the weekend and then, of course, today, Sean Spicer's big first full press conference, and then Donald Trump did something that Barack Obama should have done, and that is cancel the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
And, if I might add, do it and then bring in a bunch of labor leaders and sit around and talk to them about trade and jobs and working with unions.
Yeah, although this is going to be interesting to see what happens here. This is a man who's called national right to work.
Well, there was a great line. I mean, we shouldn't get too far ahead of ourselves because there's so many things to talk about here, but there was an incredible line in the meeting between Donald Trump and the union leaders. One thing that's really remarkable, and it ought to be pointed out, is that this is a guy who's actually worked with unions, knows union leaders, knows union contractors, and so they're sitting around in this small talk before, you know, he's talking, oh, hey, the sheet metal workers, you guys have done some great work for me. And then he's talking about projects and things, and they're talking back. And you're like, well, this is interesting. Here you have a president of the United States who actually knows not just the names of unions, but knows the leaders of those unions and is able to engage with them, you know, and talk about, you know, joint partnerships and things they've done. And there's a lot. You know, there's a lot to be noted there. And then, though, you realize the disconnect and kind of the horrible, almost agonizing disconnect here. And that is, he says to some of them, well, and you know my vice president, Mike Pence, or a lot of you know my vice president, Mike Pence. And, of course, they do because he's been one of the most ardent anti-union people in the United States of America. You know, so, yeah. It's
bizarre. Well, of course, this is the... You know, the Mitch Daniels, who obviously was Scott Walker's role model for busting unions, and then Mike Pence, they had all promised not to do right to work in Indiana, which went after some of the unions that were in that room.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then, so you've got all that there, and then let's just throw on, he also just did a freeze in federal hiring, which is going to make the jobs of unionized federal workers dramatically more difficult. Going to make things a lot harder in communities across this country. Remember, the overwhelming majority of federal employees are not in Washington, D.C. They're at veterans hospitals, and they're working on bases, and they're, you know, working in parks and doing things across this country. And he just put a freeze on new hiring. And I will tell you, that is going to make a lot of people's lives a lot harder. And so, you know, you put all these pieces together, and you see things that on the top line news report, you know, you cancel the TPP. It's going to going to do some renegotiating of NAFTA. These are significant things, and they have potential to open up whole new directions for this country. Some things that people have argued that we ought to be thinking about is a different trade policy, for instance. And yet at the same time, you know, this tin ear, bringing up Mike Pence with union leaders. I mean, come on. It'd be like bringing up Margaret Thatcher with miners in England.
Right.
Well,
I noticed something else.
These are bizarre days.
Yeah, I noticed something else today that went on. First with Sean Spicer, then with comments they played from Donald Trump on trade. And this was something that he didn't bring up during the campaign. Suddenly it was like, oh, yeah, I canceled the TPP, but I'm still for bilateral trade agreements, you know. He seems to think that, you know, what makes trade agreements that have been passed in the past somehow with a variety of countries the sin. No, that isn't the sin. It's the entire platform they're built on. You know, right. The deal with South Korea was a bilateral agreement, right?
Well, Sly, our biggest challenge of all, right, which is our relationship with China, is, you know, grew out of the permanent normalization of trade relations with China.
Right.
Right. And now that wasn't directly a classic bilateral agreement, but it was a change in our trade policy made to, you know, clear the way for much more trade relationship, much greater trade relationship with China. And through that door has been driven, you know, a dramatic dislocation of American industries from this country to China, and tremendous job shifts, as well as a kind of a buildup of new industrial capacity in China. And, you know, so the notion that we're going to bilateral trade agreements without really thinking these things through, that's a big deal. The other thing that I think is sort of unsettling in all this is the notion that we're going to do this country by country, right? Without setting down, you know, a baseline of standards that should apply everywhere. Now, I don't mind bilateral trade relationships. I think they can be a much better way of going at this often.
Yes, but if they're built on the same platform as previous deals, they're going to be a problem.
And also, and if you have a set of standards, which is that we're going to respect you know, the rights of workers to organize and also to get a decent pay, decent benefits. We're going to respect the environment. We're going to respect democracy. And here's a big deal when you start talking about bilateral agreements: respect for human rights. Because you realize that when you're talking about the countries that were involved in the TPP, you've got a lot of different approaches to human rights in those countries and to labor rights, frankly. So we're entering into a new area, and I'm going to tell you something, Sly, because you seem very upbeat today, and so I want to bring you down a little. Okay?
I seem upbeat today? Really?
Well, I'm just teasing you.
Okay, good.
Because I want to bring it down.
Because I do want to give him credit for canceling the TPP. I don't want people to think I'm poo-pooing it. That's a big deal that he did that. But I'm concerned about what the final outcome of what sort of policies he has is going to be, because I don't think he fully understands what's wrong.
Yeah, that's my point. And so that's why I want to bum you out a little
bit. Okay, yeah, go ahead and bum me out.
You know, our Senate folks are moving today, at least at the committee level, on advancing that Rex Tillerson nomination. And now the Republicans, you know, people like Marco Rubio have essentially collapsed as critics. And so we're ending up in a situation where it looks very much like Tillerson's going to be approved as Secretary
of State. And John McCain collapsed.
Yeah, so did Marco Rubio.
Uh-huh. So did Lindsey Graham.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So here's a big deal. Because the objection to Tillerson was that he, like Trump, seems to be obsessed not with trade, be it fair or free, but with relations with a handful of countries, including Russia, and, you know, creating new global power blocks. And that also becomes a part of the trade relationship. Because, for instance, what happens when you're looking at oil importation and exportation issues in a circumstance like this? And so we are about to put the just a couple days ago CEO of ExxonMobil at the center of our trade relations. And so that's a whole new element of this that people have to understand. And so I will say the final thing on this, at least for me, and that is the biggest bummer of all. I don't think that our media has the capacity, the interest level, the background, or frankly, the sensibility necessary to cover what we're going into. And so I think they are very likely to cover it in the most simplistic of ways.
I could tell by the question. Yeah, I could tell by the questions being asked at the press conference today. They were going to cover it in a very simplistic way,
and that they'll cover a lot of it through relations with the U.S. and Russia and U.S. and China, and you know, kind of the core issues, the deeper issues on all of this: labor rights, environmental protection, human rights, democracy itself. I just think those things are going to get lost in much the same way they have been in the past, but because they're now potentially, remember how, you know, how now we say, wow, there's so many things happening today, it's hard to know what to talk about. What happens when we're negotiating 180 bilateral trade agreements? I think the media is really going to do a great job of covering human rights in Myanmar.
Well, I did notice one thing, that they did not go as far as to say that they were pulling the ripcord on NAFTA as far as, you know, using the provision for Donald Trump to start renegotiating that.
Hey, yeah. Did you see what Lori Wallach's been noting?
What did she note?
You realize, well, this is a very important thing. You realize that TPP...
And by the way, we should explain Lori Wallach is with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Yeah,
and she's the, you know, if you want to, it's not Trump who's upsetting TPP. It's Lori Wallach and people like her who have been objecting for years and made this moment possible. But what Lori Wallach was pointing out is, do you know that TPP is not the only major global trade agreement that's in play right now? You've also got the European variation on this, and then you also have a whole set of regulatory negotiations that are going on. And Trump didn't, or at least so far hasn't, given clear signals on a whole bunch of those things. And so we're in this weird situation where we know that he knows about the TPP, and he made that a big deal, and he announced that he was going to get rid of it, and today he withdrew from it. But what we don't know is what he's going to do with very parallel, maybe not equally significant, but certainly major, major trade agreements and trade negotiations that are in play. And so...
Well, and let me give you an example.
Oh, yeah.
A European trade deal. That European trade deal could very well force American cheesemakers to have to use different names for their cheese.
Absolutely. And then there's a whole set of regulatory and standards negotiations going on related to that. So this is big deal stuff. And here's the painful thing. Multinational corporations in a kind of incoherent circumstance still have a tremendous number of avenues to game the system. And so I don't know at the end of this day where we talk so much about TPP, trade, NAFTA, et cetera, I don't know whether we can say that workers necessarily have, you know, kind of moved to the front of the agenda.
Well, because...
In fact, I would go so far as to say I think that there's a real good chance that they aren't there.
Well, we will see. But I do know this. Donald Trump wasn't talking about bilateral trade agreements being better than multi-party trade agreements during the campaign. This is a new one today, and I just wonder, this is speculative on your part, but what are the negotiations with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, two of the biggest free traders and two of the biggest proponents before things started getting hot and heavy of the TPP?
Right. Yeah. Well, here's the thing the one thing that I would emphasize to you. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are not experts on trade policy.
No, but their masters are.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm going to say. I don't think they frankly have any great, you know, engagement with it beyond doing what they're told to do by their campaign donors. I can't imagine there's anybody that seriously debates that, right? That and thinks, wow, these guys really are philosophically engaged, that they're, you know, deep thinkers about trade. No, I mean, they invariably do what Wall Street and multinational corporations want done. And in this circumstance, it is within the realm of possibility that Trump can sort of reposition how we do trade deals, but still keep them very favorable to multinational corporations. They may be a little more favorable to corporations that keep plants in the U.S., that bring work back. That's a positive. I mean, I want plants in the U.S., and I want work back here. But you can still have a situation that undermines the condition of working families. And trade deals are a way that happens. Remember, so in a bilateral trade agreement, for instance, you can still have the sort of separate tribunals that sort out disputes, right?
At the World Trade Organization.
Well, but World Trade Organization would be one, but you could also have within the dispute. If I negotiate a trade agreement with you, Sly, I can say, and every part of this agreement in each country can be run through the courts of the country that is involved, and this agreement can at every turn be regulated by communities, states, or the federal government in the two countries that are involved, right? That's given a lot of democratic power to the great mass of people out there. Or I can say, if there are any disputes between these two countries, we write it into our agreement that those disputes will be resolved by a trade tribunal that's set up as part of this agreement. You could do that. And that would put us right back in the mess
right.
that we're in as regards NAFTA, only we'd be in it in another form. So
all right.
That's why all this has to be discussed.
Before we get too far in the weeds, I want to obviously play the clip heard around the world. This was really remarkable. Kellyanne Conway went on Meet the Press Sunday morning. This is the day after Donald Trump complained about the media and their reporting that there were fewer people at his inaugural, and then sending Sean Spicer out to read a screed aimed at the press. So this is Kellyanne Conway and Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
And you did not answer the question.
You did not answer
the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered.
Chuck,
was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods. You sent the press secretary out there to utter a falsehood on the smallest, pettiest thing.
I don't think anybody can prove that. Look, I actually don't think that. Maybe this is me as a pollster, Chuck, and you know data well. I don't think you can prove those numbers one way or the other. There's no way to really quantify crowds. We all know that. You can laugh at me all you want, but
I'm just befuddled.
But you are, and I think it's actually symbolic of the way we're treated by the press. The way that you just laughed at me is actually symbolic of the way, very representative of the way we're treated by the press. I'll just ignore it. I'm bigger than that. I'm a kind and gracious person. But let me tell you something else. I'm really glad that NBC News and Chuck Todd all of a sudden are so thrilled to cover crowd control, because we were mocked daily for talking about the significance of our historic rallies during the campaign.
All right. Your thoughts.
Sly, you're a jerk. And I know you're going to respond to me by objecting to that.
No, actually.
I'm not going to get bothered because I'm a bigger and more gracious person than that. I mean, was that not a bizarre thing? She accuses him. She accuses Chuck Todd of massive bias, of being engaged in an effort to literally fool the American people into believing their own eyes. And then when Chuck Todd says, well, ho, we're looking at the actual photos. We're looking at actual numbers here. We're looking at real measures here. And she says, that's what you say, but as a pollster, I can tell you, none of this is real and it's all fake and or whatever. She didn't actually say that, but, basically she says you can't quantify things. And so she's accusing him of a lot of stuff. And then she's playing this game of saying, but I'm not going to respond when you challenge me because I'm a bigger, better person than that. And at the core of this, and I think that's why it's good you played the whole clip. I've been on a few shows where they played just parts of the clip. Where it gets really interesting is that she actually gave an illustration there of alternative facts, right? She's being challenged from a standpoint of reality. And then she is, finding another poll and saying, I can't believe you're not respecting this alternative set of information. And this gets to the heart of a huge problem in the American discourse. We have had this notion that a good news report is balanced between two opinions, right? you know, here's what these folks say and here's what those folks say. And that's not a good news report, Sly, because that gives equal authority in a debate to somebody who may be stating all the facts, maybe very honest, very true, and somebody who may be lying through their teeth.
Well, Sean Spicer comes out and said, well, I was trying to include the number of people streaming and watching on the internet. Well, if you listen to a statement from over the weekend, he separated the two. He gave the appearance that it was the most watched in person and the most watched around the world. So he was trying to get around that he said them separately, but he did say them separately. Today, Rush Limbaugh is telling his listeners that the pictures were taken at different times, that the Obama inaugural, that picture was taken at the moment Obama was about to address people, and that the Trump one was taken much earlier in the day. But I was watching the coverage, and that's how the crowd looked like throughout the entire ceremony.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look. And
it's really no big deal.
I disagree with you. There I'm going to push back a little bit.
Okay, will you push back?
I think it is a big deal. If a guy who's elected with a minority of the votes, who's opposed by 54% of the people, who loses to his main opponent by 3 million votes, is being sworn in at a time when his poll numbers are actually below where they were when he was elected, and he draws a tepid, uninspired crowd to his inauguration, I think that is newsworthy. I think that is worthy of note. I think it's also worthy of note that the Women's March in Washington drew more people. It was a bigger event. You make these comparisons, Sly, because we have a right to assemble and to petition for the redress. That's a part of our process.
Now let me push back.
We ought to take these numbers.
I'm going to push back a little bit. All right?
All right.
The one thing Kellyanne Conway's right is that there were people that were dismissive of Trump's crowd, saying that that was not instructive in how the election was to come out. But more importantly, you know, the crowds that showed up during the fight over Act 10 on our side versus their side were much bigger, but really did not come to fruition when it came to Cinco Goodbye Day on June 5th, 2012.
But here's where this is my point. Let me ask you this core question. If when the recall election, instead of a recall election, if we'd had a veto override like they have in Ohio, and you had just put Act 10 on the ballot, and that's what people were protesting, if you had just put Act 10 on the ballot, would it have lost?
No. I mean, Act 10 would have lost, yes.
Yeah. So Act 10 would have lost.
Yeah.
And so they benefited by the fact that we don't have that avenue, and so they were able to create a personality-based political fight in which tens of millions of dollars are flooded in. I will argue that if we did respect crowd sizes, and we respected the massive outpouring of people who said in February of 2011, Act 10 is a bad idea, you could have had the realization of what would have occurred in a democracy, i.e. that if people had a chance to vote on Act 10, they would have voted no on it, as they did by a 61-39 margin in Ohio. But because we dismiss crowds, and because we have now, particularly on the right, a criticism of crowds and say, oh, well, you know, we don't have to take that seriously, and they have all sorts of ways to demean and dismiss protest and dissent, even though it is a constitutionally defined part of our process. And all I would suggest to you is that we should take crowd sizes seriously. We should recognize the dynamic. Doesn't mean that a sitting leader has to change everything because a crowd comes out and protests or because a crowd comes and cheers him or her. But what it does mean is that we have all these people running around saying, well, crowd sizes don't matter that much, right? Except they obviously matter immensely.
Oh, they absolutely do.
He launched his presidency.
They were absolutely they matter to Donald Trump. I just mean in the scheme of things, it was stupid for him to behave the way that he did over.
Well, here you and I are in total agreement, because here we're talking, Sly, about strategy and tactics versus governing, right? And was it unimaginably bizarre, just beyond comprehension, wrongheaded, to launch your presidency whining about crowds and stuff like that, and to send your aides out on Saturday night to blow the whole thing up? Yes, of course it is. But that's clearly a part of what's going on in this country. The president of the United States is obsessed with his legitimacy or lack thereof. And the crowds that come and cheer him versus the crowds that come and boo him matter to him at a level that is almost unimaginable. And so we should recognize, I would just say that those of us who might dissent against Mr. Trump should recognize the enormous power, I think perhaps far greater than many of us imagined, of that right to assemble and petition for the redress of grievances. It looks like it makes a lot of sense to be in the streets.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.